I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. One of the top issues of last year's election was health care. Most voters saying they were unhappy with our current system, and no wonder. It's expensive, costing $3.5 trillion a year, more than $10,000 a person. That's a big chunk of our GDP, and the costs keep going up. In fact, it's one of the reasons people declare personal bankruptcy. It's also complicated and unwieldy for both consumers and providers who complain about the paperwork and the bureaucracy. It looks like the election of Liberal Democrats in November has revived the idea of some form of government-run health care. In fact, there's a new Medicare for All caucus in the House of Representatives with 77 members, and it looks like some candidates for president in the Democratic Party largely favor the idea. So what would it mean to replace the current system with something closer to Medicare or a single payer? We have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. It's David Rubin. He's an attending physician and the founding co-director of Policy Lab at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. David, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And joining us by telephone is Matt Brunig. He's founder of the People's Policy Project. That's a crowd-funded left-wing think tank in Washington, D.C. Matt Brunig, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We might disagree about how to fix the current system that we have, but let me give you both a chance to weigh in on the current system of healthcare in America. David, we're talking about half of the population gets their insurance through work. There's Medicare, there's Medicaid, there's Obamacare, there's CHIP, and there are the uninsured. Do we have the worst system in the world?
I wouldn't say we have the worst system in the world. I'm an optimist in general. And I think that we have a lot of capability in our healthcare system. We're just not harnessing it the way we need to.
So there's potential there, but
There's potential, but the system is really fragmented right now, and it's not incentivized in the way it needs to be to actually achieve the kind of impact that people want to have from their healthcare providers in their system. And what I mean by that is, people talk about coverage a lot, and Medicare for All is largely, at least in terms of the slogans around Medicare for All, sort of you envision everyone getting covered,
right?
But at the dinner table and among my patients in general, what people are talking about is that they can't afford health care. And even when they try to make an appointment, they either can't get an appointment, or when they're transitioning from a hospital to home or from a primary care office to specialists, no one's helping them navigate. And to me, at the fundamental level, that's where the conversation needs to be, because an insurance card without those items is really not coverage.
Matt, let me get you in on the conversation. We're talking about coverage. We're talking about costs. We're talking about access. How do you see the current system that we have? And then we'll talk about how to make it better.
Yeah, so U.S. pays more for health care than any other developed country as a percentage of GDP and as a percentage of total consumption, but yet we still have 30 million people who don't have any health insurance coverage, and we don't seem to get much value out of the system, certainly not more than our peer nations who spend much less than we do and manage to cover everybody.
If the Affordable Care Act weren't being picked apart by the GOP and by others as well, Matt, do you see potential in that?
I don't like the Affordable Care Act model. I generally think that private insurers and the employer-based insurance system is unnecessary and unhelpful. The ACA doubled down in many ways on our employer-based insurance system, which, as you mentioned, around half of Americans, including children and spouses, are covered by. But employer-provided health care, the main issue with it, among many, is that when you change employers, you lose your coverage. And it's really quite a traumatic and painful and annoying experience that I've had to deal with myself. The average worker, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, changes jobs about 12 times between the ages of 18 and 50. And so you're talking about changing insurance 12 times. You might be in the middle of a care regimen, and now you've got to switch to a new doctor. So anything that maintains the link between employment and health care, I think, is untenable. And we need to move beyond that.
David, let me go back to you. And let's just take, I realize Medicare for all, that means different things to different people. But let's take the current Medicare system that we have, which covers obviously older Americans. The administrative cost for that is a lot less than for private insurance. People are covered. There seems to be a general feeling that the people who get Medicare use it feel pretty good about the system. Why not take that and just make the whole country buy into Medicare, the current Medicare system?
I think the concept of getting everyone a full benefits package that they, for all their needs is important. And while there is a lot of satisfaction to have that safety net, particularly among older Americans, at the end of the day, is there experience? I would question whether the experience of care for older Americans, they are seeing now the challenges around the fragmentation of their healthcare services. I have a family member right now who's in the hospital who's in a waiting room in the emergency department because there's no access even to get up into the beds in the hospital because the emergency rooms have become a repository for people who have poor access to their providers. So I don't disagree that the model in general of providing a full benefits package is important, but there are significant issues in terms of how we construct a system that provides people access to their providers outside the hospital and incentivizes particularly the healthcare systems and the insurance companies to build a system of care to keep people away from the hospital and actually keep them as healthy as possible.
Matt, let me go back to you. David mentioned insurance companies, and I'm wondering from your perspective, if we think about things like the insurance company or drug companies or medical device companies or whoever else is involved in our healthcare system, do you see them having a role?
Well, certainly the current healthcare providers, hospitals, doctors, nurses, drug companies, medical device makers, they continue to have a role. The health insurance system, the health insurance sector, in my view, as a proponent of Medicare for All, I don't see them as having a crucial role or as adding a whole lot of value. From a kind of very technocratic perspective, every dollar that we pay to health insurance margins, to their profits, and every dollar that we pay for duplicative administration, for billers and that sort of thing, all those dollars are wasted, complete, total waste. And so I think shifting to a universal single insurer where we don't have to pay the margin, we don't have to pay for this massive army of billers, that is a huge benefit and a huge source of potential cost savings that we should take advantage of. So I say providers stay, but insurers need to go.
Let me give David a chance to respond to that. I mean, there's a kind of elegance to a simple system. One insurer. Are you okay there, Matt?
I'm all right.
Okay, as long as you're okay, we will ignore that. But there's a certain elegance and attractiveness to the idea of a simple system like that. Is
Absolutely.
That possible?
Absolutely. I think one of the major attractions to Medicare for All plan is simplifying. I think providers would love that, right? In some ways, that aspect of not having to deal with multiple insurance companies. I think continuous coverage is a really important aspect of those plans. But I don't want to let the providers off the hook either.
Okay.
It's easy to villainize the insurance companies. The cost of healthcare is too much, and we're not providing good – we're providing fragmented care. Simplifying the system doesn't necessarily correct those problems. And so what I'm trying to do is train more to what is it going to take? How do we look at any of these initiatives in the context of creating access and affordability and a good experience of care for the people who are trying to – achieve that for themselves and their families.
But how do you keep costs down or even drive costs down, mm-hmm. provide access to everybody and also provide them good care with good outcomes. Mm-hmm. Is that possible?
Yeah, and there's certainly Medicare for All. What it does is it provides purchasing power, right, for the government to act if they so choose, right, because this depends on the administration, to regulate and be an active purchaser of what they want people to provide, right? Whether that's rate setting in terms of what they're going to pay or how they're going to constrain costs, et cetera. I think the question is, how do you get there? Do you just turn the system upside down all at once? Or do you take incremental steps because – which is what I think you're seeing now when you get into the nuance of what's happening is that states aren't waiting necessarily for the government to lead the way and create a Medicare for All. People are – you know, the states are trying to take care, and a lot of individual communities are trying to address this issue right now. And in that, there's a lot of interesting things going on.
Do you favor, Matt, an incremental approach or just, you know – tear the system apart and put something better in its place? Oh, do we not? We don't have him. Matt is going to call us back. He's going to go someplace quiet. Okay, fair enough. Let me go back to you, David. You work with children. Mm-hmm. You work with CHIP, the CHIP program, which provides health care for children. Also, children are covered, I guess, under Medicaid, is
under
right?
Under Medicaid as well, too.
Is that a system that you think we can apply to the rest of us?
Yeah, we talk about, you know, a lot of the spending in healthcare is in adults, but there's so much to learn from what's going on in the dependent care market in among the children's coverage. There's a roadmap there, I think, that for a Medicaid for All advocate, we talk about Medicare and the over 65 crowd because they're already there in some ways. But there's a roadmap of transition that's happening among the children that's really instructive to this debate and doesn't get featured as much. And let me explain
that.
So Medicaid was set up to largely provide insurance cover and a comprehensive set of benefits for children, mostly poor children, whose families couldn't afford health care for their children and some other categories to provide wraparound coverage or sometimes the dominant coverage for disabled children, for children in foster care. So there are specific categories. But over time, you know, and starting in the, you know, the night, you know, when they created the CHIP program, they realized that working families were having a hard time affording coverage for their children. And there were folks who were making just a little bit too much money to qualify for Medicaid. They weren't, you know, but they couldn't afford or they weren't being offered coverage through work. And so the Children's Health Insurance Program was created as a state option to create their own program. Some states just added kids from working families into their Medicaid program, but other states like Pennsylvania, where we've been the leader in CHIP, if you ask me, created a program of commercial insurance where families could, with subsidies, kind of get access to a comprehensive set of benefits that included vision, dental, medical health care, rehabilitative services, mental health care, exactly what you would want for a comprehensive package. Now, over time, those plans have remained comprehensive, both in Medicaid and CHIP, and they've minimized cost sharing, like deductibles and the kind of copays that drive people crazy, right? And so what's happened is, as employers have sort of, as your plan at work has gotten worse and worse, and you're paying more and more out of pocket for your kids, a lot of families who are making $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 a year started to look at the Medicaid and the CHIP program, and they could qualify for these programs. And there's been a migration of families now so that most of the folks in the Medicaid and CHIP program in this country are working families.
Are you making a case for Medicaid for All then?
Well, I'll tell you know, what I think is finishing this, the story is we're at a point now where nearly half the children in this country are either in the Medicaid or CHIP program, which does a couple things. When a program is that large, most providers now take Medicaid to care for children. So Medicaid has a lot of leverage and a lot of influence if they choose to leverage it. The other thing I like about Medicaid, which is different than Medicare and doesn't get talked about as much, is that Medicaid is a state-administered program. There's an attractiveness to having the federal government be the end-all and be-all for Medicare, right? But there's also a lot of dysfunction that we're seeing coming out of D.C. And in many ways, the states have more responsibility and actually can react to local community needs in a more nimble way than a federal government can. And so the other thing and the final thing that Medicaid and CHIP do is they limit cost sharing. I mean, Medicare, you know, sort of like Obamacare, is exposing seniors now to more and more deductibles and copays. So costs, when prices go up, the costs are being passed to the consumer, not just in the taxes they're paying to support Medicare, but also now what they're paying for their health care. They don't have that luxury in Medicaid, so the only way to keep prices down is to push back on the providers and the payers to make a deal to actually improve the value of the care they're delivering.
That's really interesting. Matt, do we have you back?
I'm here. Sorry.
You're safe and sound, hopefully.
No fire.
David was talking about the CHIP program or children being covered under the Medicaid program, more low-income children, and seeing that as a way forward. I'm curious whether that's something that you've looked at all.
Oh, well, that you know, anytime you can move more people onto public insurance is, I think, a good move, especially, you know, since my goal is to eventually have everyone onto public insurance. You know, I don't see these things as competitive or alternatives to one another. I know Vermont a few years ago, before the election of Trump, was looking at potentially expanding Medicaid to all children in the state, 100% of children. And, you know, as far as states go, that seems like a really good reform. Children are relatively inexpensive to insure. They don't consume that much health care. And we already insure so many through Medicaid as it is. So that strikes me as a very sensible kind of incremental path to moving more and more people onto the public rolls. And if you're in a state where people are amenable to that, then you should do that. But we have to be serious in recognizing that there are a lot of states where the politics just aren't like that, right? I mean, we saw under Obamacare the potential for states to expand Medicaid coverage to a large, hundreds of thousands of their population, and they just didn't in many states, especially conservative states, especially states that have disproportionate Black populations. And so, you know, we can't rely on states through the Medicaid program, I think, to get us to universal coverage, and certainly not to get us to universal public coverage.
We're almost up in a break here. David, you're a physician. Do providers alike, either Medicare or Medicaid, do they feel like that's a better system for them as a provider compared to private insurance?
And it's complicated, right? You know, Medicaid rates tend to be much lower than Medicare rates. And both systems, I think, you know, providers fear political jockeying, if you will, around their rates and how they get paid. And there's a lot of fragmentation in how these rates are sort of downstream effects and how, you know, it's all that simplification discussion we had before. But the bottom line is, and to some degrees, Matt is correct, right? You know, it's harder to imagine that all states are going to follow suit, but it's also aspirational to talk about Medicare for All right now. We can't wait for that large package, and maybe a political window will open up if there's a dramatic shift in this country.
But in the meantime,
there's a lot of progress going to be made when states are expanding Medicaid, not just for children, but for adults, and when then they're starting to think about opt-ins for other families to purchase that coverage.
And that's David Rubin, who joins us along with Matt Brunig, and we are talking about the possibility of a single-payer system or Medicare for All. Stay with us, or Medicaid for All. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and we're talking about whether the time is right for a single-payer system or Medicare for All. We're talking about how to control costs and improve access to care with our guest, David Rubin. He's an attending physician and founding co-director of Policy Lab. That's at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And with Matt Brunig, and he's founder of the People's Policy Project. You can join us. A lot of people want to join the conversation, not surprised. 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We want to know what you think. Let me take a call or two, and I have some comments as well, but let's begin with David calling us from Maple Glen. David, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi,
great
there.
Show.
Thank you.
I just wanted to explain that I spent two summers ago, 5 days in an NHS hospital in Oxford, being checked out for possible congestive heart failure, which fortunately turned out not to be the case. But the bill at the end of 5 days was $900. It took me 9 months to get reimbursed by Blue Cross here for that, and they deducted $300. But the interesting thing is I had a fantastic experience, no waiting. I had great doctors. They gave me a pulmonary and a cardio specialist. They gave me as much time as I needed to ask questions. I got all tests, like CAT scans and everything, that would have cost thousands of dollars here. And what I saw was a system that, even though it's been defunded since the Thatcher years, year after year, and is really struggling for finances, delivers excellent care, as good as here, as I was told by the cardiologist I came to see at Penn when he looked at my discharge papers. And when he finished up the tests, you know, the bill that Blue Cross had to pay at Penn for no admission, just for some tests, was over $12,000.
Hmm.
And I was never spent a day in the hospital here. So it's an appalling system we have here, and an extremely workable one in England, where they pay less than half per capita for health care than we spend.
Well, David, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And I mean, we have all heard these anecdotes. We've also heard horror stories as well. But let me give you, Matt Bruning, a chance to respond. Is that what you're looking for?
Well, the NHS is a single-payer, single-provider system, meaning that the government also runs the hospitals for the most part. It's similar to our VA system here for veterans. So the Medicare for All position is to have a single payer, meaning the government is the national health insurer, but to maintain private providers. It's just easier at this point. We're going to nationalize all the hospitals or something. Would be very, very difficult. But in general, yes, I mean, that kind of experience is what we have in mind. In fact, we have a somewhat better experience. Instead of being billed $900, perhaps should be billed nothing, or maybe a nominal copay of $20, $30. And in fact, I think in the NHS, if you are a UK citizen, you wouldn't have gotten that $900 bill either. So, yeah, I mean, generally much cheaper out-of-pocket expenses, go to the doctor, don't have to worry about it, just covered just because you're a citizen. That is the idea, and that is what you see in the UK, though it is a slightly different setup.
But generally speaking, Matt, we're talking about someone's got to pay for this. So I'm assuming taxpayers in Britain are paying for their National Health Service.
That's right, yes. You would increase the tax level. I have a piece up at peoplespolicyproject.org called How to Fund Medicare by Reforming Payroll Taxes. But basically, just as we fund Medicare right now for elderly people through payroll taxes, you would increase the payroll tax, and that would provide the funds necessary for it. But what's important to note about that is payroll taxes are charged as a percent of income.
Right.
So you might pay 10 or 15% of your income to health care instead of paying $10,000. And so if you have a high income, of course, you're going to be paying more. But if you have a middle or lower income, you'd be paying less.
David, you're a physician. Does the fact that we are, I think, broadly speaking, a rather unhealthy country, we've got chronic diseases, we've got obesity, we have, you know, it seems that we really use the system or need the system because there's so many people in this country that are not in tip-top health. Does that explain in part why we have the system that we have and that it is so expensive?
I think it contributes to it, but I think it largely, again, alleviates the concerns, I think, what the caller just said, which is it just our healthcare costs too much.
Yeah.
And I agree with Matt that I think that you know, the UK has advantages because it is a single delivery system, and they're able to make decisions the key here is as an active purchaser, right? To say how much they're going to spend and pay for that hospital care, how much they're going to invest in services to providers who are in the ambulatory side where most of the care is received, right? And therefore really regulate the cost. And in many ways, it's rationing, right? And it's basically you have a budget and you're going to stick to a budget and you're going to figure out how to spend for it. So there are a lot of advantages there. But in our system, I think Matt also pointed out that we're not going to a nationalized hospital system anytime soon. And so therefore, it's even more important, how are we going to incentivize these healthcare systems or to actually ensure that we can bring costs down, because it's going to be much harder here to achieve what that caller saw in England without that single delivery system.
Matt, speak to us about rationing. It's the R word, I guess, that hangs over a conversation like this. My understanding is that we pay a lot of health care in the last year of someone's life. Is rationing, and do we have to be just sort of honest if we're going to live within certain parameters, that we're just going to have to decide who gets care for what reasons?
Well, I think rationing is a little bit of a loaded term. I mean, in any society that doesn't have infinite resources, you are necessarily involved in rationing, necessarily deciding who gets this house instead of that house and so on. And the same is true in our healthcare system. There are only so many doctors in our healthcare system. Maybe we can make more by educating more people to become doctors or something like that. But there's only so many doctors. They only have so many hours in a day. There's only so many hospital rooms, et cetera, et cetera. So that's just the nature of the beast. You have scarce resources. You have to figure out where to allocate them. But one of the charms of a single-payer system, especially if it's done well, is you can allocate scarce resources based on healthcare need. Who needs this hospital room the most? Who needs this doctor's attention most, as opposed to based on ability to pay? So the sickest people get the care, not the richest people. But in general, yes, I don't think you want to get to the point where you have so few doctors and such little medical supply that you're having to make really tough calls. You want to get to the point where, okay, maybe you have to wait a couple of months to get an elective knee surgery or something like that. But rationing is part of every system. It's just a question of who rations and how they want to do that.
Supply and demand. I'm looking at you, David.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, I think that's what's attractive about Medicaid for All. It's like it satisfies demand, but it doesn't really address supply, right?
And do we need a different sort of hierarchy?
You know, fundamentally, I mean, I think when I look at what excites me about the innovation in healthcare today is that I think the most promising approach is that we need a more integrated care approach for how we take care of not just children but adults and our elderly, where it's not just a physician, it's a nurse, it's a social worker, it's often a community navigator or what we call a community health worker. And those integrated teams, now the technology exists to help them to develop workflows that more proactively identify and get us access to the people that need our help. The problem is, while we know what the solution looks like, we don't know how to pay for it. And it's going to take some level of will, not just political, but at the negotiating table between payers and providers, to acknowledge you can't pay a fee for service for someone who calls someone three times that week and stops by their house on the way home from work to make sure they're doing okay, right? We need to be able to finance these teams up front, hold people accountable for what those teams are doing and audit them, but acknowledge that that's the way forward and if we're really going to deliver better value care that people actually desire.
Let me read some comments, and then we'll get Ron from Mount Airy to join us. A comment from Nancy. You mentioned people are unhealthy. They're unhealthy because so many people don't have access to health care because the system is so bad. An email from Carol. Medicare supposedly is causing huge budget problems, so I don't see how we can afford Medicare for All. And I wonder if we have enough hospitals and doctors to provide medical care for all of us, something that both of you had just mentioned. A Facebook comment from Peggy says, how does the high cost of education for doctors impact the cost of medical care? Back to you, David. Just briefly, do you see that as a factor?
Certainly it contributes. You know, I think, you know, doctor reimbursement, but actually I think it's more complex. I think it's hospital reimbursement. I think the hospitals are still the central pillar of our healthcare system. For any of you out there listening to this show who's ever gotten a bill for a procedure that was done at a hospital or a hospitalization, you'll see the physician fee in there, right? And it might look expensive to you, but look at the facility fee. Right?
Even bigger. But does that actually get paid, or is there you see that big number?
It's often reimbursed significantly, and that, you know, whether it's paid at 60% or 50%, those prices have been rising. Those are the ones to look at, because you might see a $250 physician fee, but you might see an $8,000 facility fee for a short visit, right, for a procedure. And so there's not a lot of transparency what that fee represents. And so most of the money is still buried in the hospital system. And while, yeah, yes, there's some contribution of physician fees, I think it's these larger less able to quantify dollar numbers that are going to support hospitals primarily at the expense of investment in our ambulatory providers.
Let me get Ron from Mount Airy to join us. And Matt, I'll give you a chance to respond to his comment. Ron, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
I'd like to touch on the cost-saving issue as it relates to state governments. I'm a welfare caseworker who's paid by taxpayers to approve but also to deny people coverage because they're over the income limit or they didn't sign their renewal form or whatever. And my point is that under a central administrative bureaucracy in which everyone is already approved, all 50 state budgets could be shored up by phasing out thousands of eligibility determination workers. And I'd like to add that the PA, Department of Human Services budget, is about one-third of the total state budget and is the biggest employer with more than 17,000 employees, many of whom are not care providers.
You're talking, I mean, obviously, Matt, he's talking about this giant bureaucracy that we have in place to run our system.
Yeah, bureaucratic streamlining is a huge potential source of cost savings. To some degree, Medicaid caseworkers who have to manage recipients and recently, the Trump administration has allowed states to put work requirements on Medicaid receipt. So now you have caseworkers making sure people are looking for jobs and that kind of stuff. Those workers could be eliminated and moved into other sectors doing more productive work than trying to track people and make sure they check certain kind of boxes. The biggest source of bureaucratic streamlining, though, is not going to be Medicaid caseworkers, but instead it's going to be people who work currently in billing departments of hospitals and doctor's offices and billing departments in insurance offices. One other source of bureaucratic streamlining that often gets missed in this is on the employer side. Employers have to spend time administering health care for their workers. They have to spend time going to try to make deals with insurers, checking it each year, hiring HR staff and that sort of thing. So there's a source of bureaucratic streamlining there as well. And when you add all that up, yeah, you do save quite a bit of money, not enough to fund the whole system, but enough to, you know, get things going.
Well, I mean, those are also jobs and people having jobs. So whether they would end up losing their jobs or finding something else to do, Matt, I mean, that's also could be a fallout if the system were drastically changed and streamlined.
Sure. Sure. I mean, but at the end of the day, we don't want to be paying people to do work that doesn't really add value. You know, the only way that the economy gets richer and the way that we grow as an economy is to take workers and from jobs that are not that productive and move them into jobs that are more productive. So every Medicare for All plan that's ever been proposed in Congress, at least, has a provision where if you are a worker who worked in one of these insurance companies or worked as a biller or something like that, you get 2 years of unemployment insurance completely covered, and you get assistance to try to get into new jobs. And one of the helpful things about the health insurance issue in particular is these workers that are going to be made redundant by the change, these are administrative workers, these are office workers, these are workers whose skills really apply in every sector. You need these kinds of workers everywhere. The same isn't true, for instance, of like coal miner jobs, which are a little bit more difficult to replace. But these workers, I think, could be reallocated into new jobs, doing more productive things than checking whether, you know, Johnny applied for 3 jobs this week in order to keep his Medicaid.
David, we're almost out of time here, but you're looking at me like you want to say something. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, I mean, obviously there's a tremendous amount of savings and simplification to remove the bureaucracy. I think it's an incredible incentive. I think the movement away from employer-sponsored insurance and the goal of getting more people to have continuous coverage that's independent of their employment decisions is a noble goal, right? No doubt about it. But if I look at the rising cost of health care, you know, you're talking about the trend and what's responsible for the trend. It's not the rising cost of administration of healthcare. It's the rising cost of healthcare, right?
Healthcare itself.
Yeah. So you can get some wins by simplifying and getting rid of the bureaucracy, and I think there's tremendous value there. But I think until we address creating a better, less fragmented system and incentivizing the right type of care that we want to provide, we're going to be in the same albatross.
Well, I hate to leave it there because I feel like we have just touched the surface. David Rubin, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And he's an attending physician, founding co-director of Policy Lab at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Matt Brunig, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And he's founder of People's Policy Project, again, a crowdfunded left-wing think tank in Washington, D.C. Appreciate all those calls and comments to the show as well. You can carry on this conversation on our Facebook page. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.